The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast is brought to you by Stock Market Hats. Stock Market Hats claim to be stylish and funny. Frankly, I wasn't that amused by some of them, but maybe you will be. And it's not just hats either, but they have t-shirts, sports bras, socks, and even pet ID tags. It's worth checking out, and right now you can take advantage of a 10% discount on all merchandise. Go to stockmarkethats.com and enter the code CONTRARIAN before you check out and take advantage of this special offer. There is a referral link I will put in the show notes as well. Stock Market Hats, claiming to be stylish and funny. All right, welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, Season 4, Episode 2, here with James Folk in Hong Kong, joining us from Hong Kong to discuss his book, Financial Cold War, A View of Sino-US Relations from the Financial Markets. James, the Sino-US relations and Chinese economy is something that comes up quite a lot on this podcast. A lot of people, as I'm sure you know, have views on this, often very opinionated views one way or another. But you are in a unique position. And you can tell us about your background later on in the book, in the show. But I want to talk about this book first and your ideas for it, because like the book suggests, there is, and it's already been used, this term Cold War between the US and China. But for all the reasons you point out in the book, this is not like a traditional Cold War like we saw between the US and the Soviet Union. The two countries have many entrenched interests, a lot of trade going on. Your premise is basically that this Cold War, to the extent that it can be called that, is going to be fought along financial markets. And so very curious to have you on the show to have you talk over this a little more. So with that, I'll just let you take it away and tell us about this book.
Well, look, I mean, the financial Cold War, as I define it in the book, is the invisible conflict embedded in the structure of the global financial system and national financial policies, which have been driving ever higher levels of wealth, income, inequality. And what this has led to is a rise in social tensions in China, in America, and in other countries, which has been driving conflict. And you know, in the financial sphere, this has spilled over into some of the more obvious things that people talk about when they think about financial cold wars, which I call actually a geoeconomic war, where people are putting sanctions or countries are putting sanctions on each other. They're limiting access to markets and they're using their financial heft to try and manipulate or contain their strategic rivals. And what I'm worried about, and the reason particularly why I've written this book, is that this now risks spilling over into ever more aggravated conflicts.
Mm. And you mentioned the trap of Thucydides, the Thucydian trap here, which is that
a rising power, be it a rising economic or military or world power, and an entrenched, the existing world power almost always, in fact, always meet militarily at some point. And there's many examples of this throughout history, going back to the Peloponnesian War, right? That is where it comes from, right? But yeah. So talk to us about that and whether you think that a military conflict between the US and China is inevitable.
No, I don't think it's inevitable, but it is highly dependent on the individual, many individual decisions taken by leaders on both sides. And you know, the fact that we understand today that you know there are these kind of cyclical dynamics in great power relations that can lead to things like the Thucydides trap means that you know, we should be better equipped to avoid them and avoid repeating those historical mistakes.
Should be and may well be, but yet there is obviously a lot of tension that has been rising, you know, over the last couple of years, you know, through the Trump presidency, of course, and more recently over Taiwan and other things. Where do you see the Sino-US, the US-China relationship right now in terms of, yeah?
Look, clearly it's not been in a great place. Mm. And you know, I think part of the problem is that, you know, as social pressures have risen in both countries, there's been a tendency for politicians on both sides to deflect the problems onto others, and particularly to pursue relatively populist and nationalist rhetoric, which has simply compounded those feelings of enmity towards each other. I think that's far from helpful.
Mm. No question. What are some ways out that we can? I mean, we already, like we said, we've already had the economic, you know, interaction between the U.S. and China. Although maybe some could argue that this has come down a little bit recently with the U.S. onshoring a lot of manufacturing, though by no means all, by no means even most. And China is still a factory to the world. So it would seem that it is in the best interest of the China and of the U.S. and Western powers to keep things the way they are, right?
Well, I think really the fates of the two countries are highly intertwined. I mean, the globalization over you know, the past 100 years has meant that you know we are ever more tied together through trade and international investment. And actually, by and large, that's been a good thing because it's helped you know, less prosperous countries become more prosperous, and it's certainly driven higher levels of growth and development than we otherwise would have had. But you know, clearly there have been imbalances in that. And one of the key problems that I point to in the book is the role of the US dollar in the global monetary system. Because you know, the dollar was put at the center of this system at the end of the Second World War. And you know, really, the system was a bad design from the outset. And you know, that wasn't widely recognized until over a decade later. But you know, by that point, it became very difficult to unwind that role of the dollar. And so you've had, you know, as global trade and global investment have increased over time, you've just had, you know, an exponential increase in those imbalances. You know, each side kind of hurls accusations at each other in terms of what the problems are. If you're sitting on the US side, you're accusing emerging markets of really you know, artificially holding down their currencies to steal US jobs. If you're sitting on the side of the emerging markets, you're sitting there at the mercy of you know, the volatility of the dollar, because quite oftentimes, your companies and your governments have had to raise money in US dollars. So when there's been a big fall in your currency against the dollar, then you've had you know, difficulties in repaying, which have led to bankruptcies, which have led to unemployment and huge human misery in those countries. And ultimately, this comes down to the fact that it was never sustainable in the first place for the dollar to play both the role of the US's national currency and the role of this global utility that everyone needs to use when they're interacting internationally in trade and investment.
Yeah, interesting points. But of course, this also serves the US's purpose to have the US, the dollar, as the reserve currency in the world. And right now, are there any realistic options to replace it in the foreseeable future?
Well, I think when you say that it serves the US's purposes, you have to really look at this carefully, because I don't think that that actually holds true at all levels of US society. So, of course, if you're a wealthy shareholder of a large US corporate, that because the US dollar has been structurally overvalued, you've been able to offshore your manufacturing to lower your costs and increase your profit margins, it's been great. I wouldn't say it's been so great if you've been a US manufacturing worker over the last 40 years.
No question.
So ultimately, this is, this comes down to a question of whether it is working for the majority of society. And one of the key points that I make in my book is actually that this belief that the dollar's global role is good for the US is a fallacy. Actually, for most people in the US today, it's actually hurting them.
Interesting. But yet the US would not be able to run its current account deficit and continue to inflate away at issue treasury bonds if the dollar wasn't the reserve currency of the world, right? And
sorry to interrupt you.
Not at all.
But actually, if the US wasn't playing this role, if it wasn't artificially overvalued to the extent that it is, that the US might not need to run those sorts of deficits.
Right. But what choice does the US have as far as whatever social spending, whatever, government things there are, it's got to be paid from somewhere, right?
Look, that comes to a different question. And the fact is that the US government has spent well beyond its means for a very long time now. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why it was able to start doing that in the first place was because there was this almost bottomless pool of international demand for dollars. But actually, that's not the case today. What's actually happening? Over the last 6-7 years, the total balance of international holdings of US treasuries hasn't really increased. Who's been buying that debt? It's been the Fed. And so at some point, although markets can stay irrational for longer than you or I can stay solvent, at some point, reality is going to catch up with the dollar. And if we don't take active steps at an early enough stage to deal with those problems, then the collapse at some later point could be quite catastrophic.
Okay, so what is China doing now to kind of take these steps to get away from U.S. dollar? Obviously, the yuan has entered the IMF's currency basket, right? And they are doing some stuff around digital currencies. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think first of all, I'll say that I think China is a very, very long way from usurping the dollar, and in fact, I don't think that China, having looked at the costs of the dollar's global role to US citizens, it actually has an aspiration to turn the renminbi into a replacement for the dollar. But certainly it has been making steps to internationalize the renminbi. And actually a lot of these steps kind of started out because of very practical reasons. They're now more, China was very closed. There weren't a lot of people traveling overseas before. Now there are hundreds of thousands of Chinese students all over the world. Chinese businesses are becoming more international. And so necessarily, China has had to make steps or take steps to allow its currency to become more convertible just to facilitate these sorts of international interactions. But the RMB is still relatively, it's still relatively tightly controlled. And the capital account is still largely closed. China's been making some steps. You talked about the digital RMB or the China Central Bank digital currency. It's been taking steps to modernize its financial system, but those are still relatively domestically focused. The digital currency is really just something which is initially intended to be used by domestic retail payments. So I think, you know, from the perspective of becoming an international currency and becoming a global reserve currency, China, if they want the renminbi to play that role, would have to take far larger steps to internationalize the currency. And particularly what they would have to do is start allowing many, many more renminbi denominated securities to be issued offshore. Because if you receive renminbi today, you know, through a commercial trade transaction, you're still sitting there, if you're in Malaysia or Indonesia, you're still sitting there scratching your head and saying, well, actually, what am I going to do with these? You know, if I get US dollars, I can put them into treasuries, I can buy any number of financial assets. Actually, if I get these renminbi, there's really not that much I can do with it outside of mainland China.
Yeah, so, and that's kind of the crux of the matter here. So, you know, how do you get that kind of credibility if you are China, or how do you switch away from dollars so that the USD is not this weapon? Like what options do you realistically have?
Well, I think to insulate itself from US financial sanctions, it is practically very difficult. China has taken some small steps, particularly through creating its own payment systems that bypass things like the SWIFT network. It's created the digital currency where actually that entire payments via the digital currency could bypass many of the infrastructures through which dollar payments are made and settled today. But you know, it's far from perfect in insulating China from US financial pressure, just simply because China is still so dependent on the dollar in its international trade, not just with the US, which is now only about 14% of its global trade, but its trade with all other countries.
Yeah. It sounds like that is kind of the main thing that needs to happen here, is that the world just needs to, not just China, but the entire world needs to become less US dollar dominated, right? If this kind of financial cold war is going to resolve itself. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. And you asked how they would get there. And
yeah.
I think that solving this is a gargantuanly complex problem. Yeah. But there are precedents. So when Sterling, the pound sterling, handed over that status to the US after World War II, Britain followed, I think, quite a stringent policy of removing the pound from that global reserve role. In 1947, pound sterling accounted for 87% of all global foreign exchange reserves. Over a period of 30 years, that the country pursued capital controls, it pursued several rounds of devaluation and had a couple of instances of IMF support and was supported by many other countries. and gradually wound down the role of pound sterling, which set the UK up, in fact, by the 1980s, then to actually significantly outperform many other European countries.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. But it's still pretty unpalatable politically, right? I mean, if you're a politician in the US, why would you try to go down that route?
Well, the reasons why that the UK did it were really because after the Second World War, there were certainly large constituencies opposed to doing that in the UK, not least the financial services sector, which was very powerful in the City of London. Hmm. But after the Second World War, Winston Churchill got voted out of power, and you had a Labour government to come into power. And when they looked at it, all said and done, Britain to continue playing that role meant continuing to absorb all the financial imbalances from the rest of the world. And what that translated into was the loss of British competitiveness and the loss of British jobs. Mm-hmm. And so, it certainly wasn't an easy decision, or a decision that was taken lightly. But it was a decision that actually benefited ultimately the majority of the electorate in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. But it does sound like there would probably need to be some kind of major economic recession or major crisis even in the US for that to become a possibility politically, one would think, no?
We've had no shortage of financial crises.
None of them have mattered. I know.
Yes.
Right. But it's still the status quo is still exactly the same, right?
I think that it certainly will need significant political impetus for that to happen, but it's not also, of course, entirely within the US's control. In that, other countries may gradually start to move away from the dollar themselves, which actually you're seeing happening to an extent. In that, other countries' central banks are no longer buying US treasuries at the rate that they were 10, 15 years ago. And so I think as that transition happens, people will look for more attractive places to park their capital. And that may well become other countries' financial assets.
So, okay.
I think this is a process which can take place via a number of different routes. What I would advocate is that it's done in a collaborative manner that actually then manages the process and avoids many of the messy disruptions that you might see otherwise.
What are these, just out of curiosity, what are these countries buying if it's not US treasuries?
Well, they've started to buy more other countries' sovereign bonds, but
okay.
There's been a significant increase in the purchase of other risk assets, so
okay.
equities, foreign direct investments, and so forth. Mm-hmm. But one of the things which China has done, instead of putting more money into U.S. treasuries, is actually starting to invest in infrastructure development in other countries through what it calls the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah. Interesting. That is interesting. Because I was going to say, there's not too many. I mean, equities is one thing, but there's risk with that. And, the U.S. Treasury, right now the 10-year yields 1.7 or some percent, maybe even more as of today. Haven't looked. And the German bunds have a negative yield. And most other European bonds do too, which is the next safest thing. So why wouldn't you put it in the treasuries if you're getting 1.8 versus zero, right?
Like, well, you put the money into Chinese government bonds. The 10-year rate is around 3.5% net.
Sure.
So this in the sovereign debt, in the sovereign debt game, given how leveraged many sovereigns are around the world, actually this is a, this is more of a game of, you know, the least bad option rather than necessarily your people actively wanting to put their money into treasuries or EGBs.
Some
investors, of course, have no choice because they're forced to hold a certain number of them.
Which brings up another question, but another problem potentially. But yeah, that's good. That's a good point. All right, how else is this, you know, financial cold war? Do you see it playing out? And what does it mean for asset prices in the US and China?
Well, I think the other ways in which the financial cold war played out have been through, you know, international tax competition, which has driven, actually, in many countries, far more regressive and unfair tax systems, simply because countries have been in a race to attract capital and investment. Capital tends to be much more mobile than labor. And so this has driven slightly balmy tax systems in which actually the very wealthy are paying far lower rates of taxation than average middle class workers. And so, you know, I can go down, the book goes down into many more individual country policies that have contributed to this financial cold war. Things like antitrust enforcement or the lack thereof, industrial policy, executive compensation structures, and other financial incentives. So I think, you know, in terms of how this plays out, I think, you know, if you look at the historical cycles, you've gone through periods of huge wealth accumulation, which is what we've been through over the past 30, 40 years. And following those periods of wealth accumulation, one of two things happens. The first option, which I think is by far the preferable, is that there's been some political consensus which has driven a level of wealth redistribution through higher taxes on the rich, greater investment in social welfare and other programs. Or you've had the violent redistribution where it's essentially precipitated civil wars, international wars, and other conflicts in which many people have their lives turned completely upside down. It's not, frankly, great for anyone who lives through any of those periods of time, but ultimately ends up in the redistribution of wealth, income, and other resources in a more fair and egalitarian way.
Okay. All right. Which scenario do you see is more likely?
I would strongly hope that we, given what we know and understand about these cycles today, that we choose the former.
Yeah, no question. I think we all do. I want to take a quick break here, give our sponsors a chance to make themselves heard. And if you are a premium subscriber, do not touch the dial. You will not get the break. To become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
This episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast brought to you by Stock Market Hats. Stock Market Hats claim to be stylish and funny. Some of them say things like end the Fed, don't tax the rich, I heart the Fed, Dr. Parik Patel, not back office. Okay, that one is actually kind of funny. Market cap cap, that's also pretty funny. And some other ones. You may know their Twitter at Stock Market Hats, but check it out, stockmarkethats.com, and enter Contrarian at checkout to take advantage of a 10% discount.
Curious to hear about your background. I read about it a little bit in the book. I know you hail from Hong Kong. You're born there. And maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that, about your professional background, how you got to be where you are now, and how you came to write this book.
I was born and grew up in Hong Kong and attended boarding school in Scotland. After that, went and spent time in university in Beijing and ended up getting a job working in an investment bank in London. Had a very interesting career in investment banking across Europe and in Asia. And in 2012, as I was changing jobs, I got a call from someone working at the exchange saying, "Hey, what are you doing? Can you come and help us out on something?" And it turned out to be the acquisition of the London Metal Exchange, which is the largest commodities exchange for trading base metals in the world. And so, thereafter, I ended up on a pretty wild ride over 10 years working at the exchange and getting involved in the internationalization of China's capital markets, which it gave me certain insights working at this intersection between financial markets and policy on how the global financial system works. And the reason for writing this book was that I felt that there were many things that even top policymakers and people who've been in financial markets for years didn't understand well and needed to understand better.
Cool. Very interesting. So how do you see things now in China? The economy has been slowing a bit. There's been real estate issues, with the real estate market, as I'm sure you're aware. But it seems that they've been able to combat it, as they have other previous crises that they've had over the last decade or so. So where do you see things going from here in China economically?
The Chinese government has done a remarkable job at engineering China's growth from being dirt poor at the outset of the 1980s to being today, on average, a moderately prosperous country. And if you go to any of China's major cities, actually a very modern and technologically advanced society. But China's development model has depended very much on the harnessing of Chinese people's savings to pursue investment in infrastructure and other development, which have enabled the growth of its export economy and the growth of its technology businesses. And while that's a very effective means of operating at the outset of economic development, as you go on for longer, this very tight control of the pricing and allocation of capital tends to lead to significant capital misallocations, which have serious economic repercussions. And for China, the biggest challenge today, I would say, is the fact that it has the one of the most rapidly aging populations in the world. The demographic cliff that the country faces is very considerable. And over time, if you keep investing in more housing, more industrial capacity in the face of a falling population, at some point you are going to have a financial blow up, because the growth in population to support that growth in consumption just isn't there.
Mm. We talk a lot about the China and the other parts of everybody in the world relying on the US for growth. And it is, like I mentioned at the outset, China, the factory of the world. Obviously, most of their customers are, I know about most, but many customers are in the US, and that's certainly true for other export nations. But what about if, how much do you know if the US corporations sell into China, and how much is that dependent on their growth? And if there is a slowdown in China, there already is, and if it gets worse, how might that affect the fortune of these companies in the US and in the West, many of whom are very dependent on China to get growth?
Well, I think, you know, there's quite a good precedent for that. If you look at what happened to Japan between the late 80s and today, in fact, if you look at the numbers, the decline in China's working age population as a percentage of the total population is likely to be much steeper than in Japan. Wow. Because you had this extended period of one-child policy. And so I think certainly China is still at the moment on a path of becoming more and more wealthy. And so I believe that US companies and international companies that are selling into China's consumer market will continue to see growth. You've also got technology-driven factors in that, you know, you've got a large move of the vehicle fleet from petrol and diesel engines into electric vehicles. And so I think many companies will continue to do very well, but, you know, companies that are solely dependent on a growth in population may find themselves disappointed.
Interesting. All right. What is your biggest concern with this whole situation, or just even anywhere else economically?
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
The economic problems are fairly clear for everyone to see. I think the things that worry me more are the implications of those economic problems if we don't deal with them, but particularly in terms of the social upheaval and conflicts that they might precipitate. Because, you know, while, you know, we can sit in our offices and, you know, crunch, you know, models about, you know, how economies and markets and your revenues are going to grow, that the reality is that, you know, if you end up with, you know, huge social unrest or wars, which nobody wants, but history has shown countries are perfectly capable of sleepwalking into, you know, all bets are off economically.
Yeah. Unless you're a weapons manufacturer, I guess. Probably their stocks would do all right. And that comes, so now we come full circle. Like, how likely do you say that? If you're gaming this out, you know China pretty well, you know the US pretty well, you certainly know Britain also. So how do you see this going out? Do you think that this is the type of thing where the interests are entrenched enough and the lessons from history are strong enough where there won't be any military interaction, or could it be more along the lines of what we did see in the Cold War, where we had, you know, client versus proxy state type of things, you know, Russians in Afghanistan, the US in Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera?
So first of all, very clearly, neither sets of leader wants to see a war between China and the US. And I think, yeah, if you take a step back, that scenario is highly unlikely, unless the politicians are put into or are backed into positions where they can't get out of them, and, you know, the risk is really in fomenting this nationalist populist type of rhetoric is that leaders back themselves into corners where they find it difficult to de-escalate when there are accidents. You know, maybe you have a plane crash, maybe you have an accident here, or a misstep there, and that is probably the most likely scenario in terms of precipitating some escalation conflict.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, if you go back to, like, let's take 1914, which is everybody's favorite example type of thing, right? I mean, you had here these empires in Europe, all of whom also had entrenched interests, and there was a lot of free good movement of goods and services and people and capital, maybe not so much services, but between these countries, and it was not in their best interest to fight a 4-year war, and ended up literally killing most of them. But it still happened. Now, obviously, the situation there with alliances, et cetera, is maybe not entirely comparable or at all comparable. But it does show that, and you mentioned this before, that the countries don't always act in their self-interest sometimes when it comes to these things.
No, they don't. But I would hope that particularly having taken the lesson of the events that led to the First World War, we're now better equipped to avoid them.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Do you see any China activity as far as the either through the Belt and Road or elsewhere that maybe hasn't been covered all that much in the West that is of interest? Because when we talk about cold wars, we also have these, and again, I know you said financial versus typical, but you have these client states, and a lot of them, especially in Southeast Asia and in the South Pacific, have kind of been a bit of a kind of diplomatic battleground between the US and China. And most of them kind of are play both sides against each other. But some have kind of fallen into China's camp and others have fallen into the US camp. Is there anything there, update that you're following that is at all interesting to listeners?
I would say that sometimes the Belt and Road Initiative is looked at with a high degree of skepticism in the West, but I think it's certainly done in some places an awful lot of good. And China has built an entirely new subway metro system in Hanoi. It's linking up rail transport routes to places like Laos and other parts of Southeast Asia that should bring greater mobility and economic prosperity to these places. So I think when some of the accusations about China deliberately creating debt traps, I think that's often far from the truth. But certainly you are right that countries in Southeast Asia and around the region don't really want to get caught between China and the US, and as best they can, they're trying to manage their diplomatic relations with both. And you could say that in some instances have taken advantage of the desire of both countries to bring them more into their respective orbits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair point. All right, cool. James Folke, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. Maybe in conclusion, you can tell listeners, finally, I'll put this in the show notes as well, where they can find out more about you, where they can find out more about the book.
Thank you very much, Nathaniel. You can find out more about me on my website, jamesafok.com. And the book is available from major booksellers and on Amazon.
Yeah, and your website has a link to all that. And like I said, I'll put that in. You're not on the social media, are you? On other than LinkedIn, which we'll leave alone for now. But you're not on Twitter or anything like that.
I'm not a big social media user, no.
All right. Well, that's probably very wise of you. Cool. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, James, for coming on the show, and thank you for being with us this week. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you very much, Nathaniel.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.